The lesson number 20 in our Bible survey course. And I might once again remind you that the course that we're studying could perhaps more accurately simply be called Bible than to be called Bible survey, because we are indeed going much further than simply surveying it. I don't apologize for that at all, because I feel, especially in the case of the book of Genesis, that if we don't get a good foundation, we don't study the things that make up the foundation for the Bible, that we're not going to be able to understand the rest of it sufficiently. So if you remember, we started out by surveying the Bible as a whole and then laying out the New Testament more specifically. And then we started through the book of Genesis trying to give you the major events of the book of Genesis. Incidentally, I have a booklet called Major Bible Events of the Old Testament, another Major Bible Events of the New Testament, and you may find these booklets helpful in the process of studying through the Bible, and especially in the case of this particular course we're calling Bible Survey. These books are available for $5 for the set, two books. I believe there are 52 lessons in the Old Testament series and 65 in the New Testament series, and they involve a narrative along with recommended scripture reading and then 20 questions. I think you'll, for each lesson, of course, I think you'll find that to be helpful along this line. In this particular lesson, we're studying the origin of the races. I think this is one of the most difficult Bible subjects to deal with that there is. Perhaps one of the most difficult to understand and certainly to be dogmatic about, but even if we could understand it and know precisely what was being stated in every case, it still becomes one that's very difficult to deal with effectively, both because of the fear and sometimes anguish on the part of the teacher and the student. This comes, first of all, because of national and racial prejudice that all of us have, and it's inherent in both the teacher and in the student. Now, a lot of people like to think that they are not prejudiced. Everybody is prejudiced. Some people are prejudiced against particular races or particular nationalities, and others are prejudiced against all who are prejudiced against those particular nations and nationalities or nationalities and races. Some weeks ago, I was driving at night, and I was listening to a talk show on the radio, and this fellow was making some kind of a statement about extreme fundamentalists and their opinions concerning religious matters, and his basic statement against them was that they just felt that everybody was wrong that didn't agree with them. And in the process of making his statement, I thought it was very striking that he seemed more bitter against fundamentalists than most fundamentalists I'd ever heard of were against anybody. And so it was striking that he felt that their intolerance was such a terrible thing, and yet he was as intolerant against them as anybody could be. So each of us have prejudice. And of course, the word prejudice simply means to prejudge something or to have an opinion about something before all of the facts are in. So we are all somewhat prejudiced, both as teachers and as students, either negatively or positively. There's another element that makes the teaching in this area very difficult, and that is the fear of being prejudiced or of teaching prejudice, or the fear of accusation of being or teaching prejudice. Once again, this comes in both the student and the teacher. In other words, nobody wants to be referred to as being prejudiced in an improper or an unfair way. And so sometimes we're just almost afraid to look into something objectively. It's not infrequent to see others or to find ourselves a little bit afraid to investigate a subject that may be contrary to our opinion, either one way or the other, for fear that we'll find ourselves accused of or being proven wrong. Accused of being wrong, I should say, or being proven wrong. Now, let me illustrate this in this fashion. The word racist today is a bad word. I mean, if someone is called a racist, you know that they're not speaking of him in an admirable fashion, but they're rather speaking of him very critically. And yet it is a very fact of life that there is a difference in races, and it's one of the most obvious facts of life. There's a court case in the state of Louisiana now concerning a woman who is being referred to as a Negro, and I understand that she's something like 1/32nd or something like that Negro, and she's perfectly white as far as her appearance and everything is concerned, yet she is referred to on certain records as being a Negro, and she's trying to sue against that. And probably has very definitely the right to do so. The only thing is that in the process of this, they're also asking the question, should there be any kind of reference at all made to the person's race? Well, whether the reference is made or not, it is a fact of life. It's something that everyone is quite aware of, and no one is more aware of the racial difference than the various races themselves. In fact, it's very likely that the races who are most critical of the race being named or referred to are the most sensitive to racial differences today. I won't get into the depth of all of that, but the fact of the matter is that race is indeed a fact of life. Well, where then did these races originate? Now, we don't have all of the answers here at all. But there are some known facts of racial distinctions and differences that we do have available to us, and we're going to try to give you as much of that as we can. I want to read to you from the book of Genesis, chapter number 9, and verses 18 and following, and show you something of the nature of division here, just the seedbed of it, not a great deal of it. Verse 18 said, "And the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. These are the three sons of Noah. And of them was the whole earth overspread." Now that's a fact that we do have before us. "And Noah began to be an husband and planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and was drunken, and he was uncovered within his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told the two brethren without," or told his two brethren without. "And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were backward and they saw not their father's nakedness. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. And he said, Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. And he said, Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died." Now, it's very clear that in the pronunciation of this judgment upon Canaan, and the blessings upon Shem and so on, that there's going to be at least national differences. Now, nothing is said at this point about racial differences at all. Understand, up to this point, all we have is national differences and a division of these three men. It's quite obvious that the divisions that Noah speaks of here go further than merely the three men themselves, but it has to do with their offspring. Canaan specifically is mentioned here, and the implications of the continuation of the offspring of these three men is very clearly set forth. Now, we know these things. First of all, we know that all of the races upon the face of the earth today, that is, if we believe the Bible to be true at all, we know that all of the offspring upon the face of the earth today are the children of Adam. All of them are in some way, indirectly or directly, the offspring of Adam. More specifically than that, we know that they are all the offspring of Noah. Genesis chapter 9, verses 18 and 19 once again. And the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. These are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. So we very clearly have set before us the fact that all of these people did come from one group. Now, different races are biologically different in many ways, not in color only. They have different personalities in many ways, the structure of their bodies, the shape of various portions of their bodies, and so on. Though there will be variation within the different races, the variations between them will be much more pronounced. The shape of their eyes, the thickness of their lips, the shape of their feet, shapes of their bodies in general. And again, these will vary, and yet the attributes will be so outstandingly different from race to race that you cannot claim that the variation within the races is as distinct, as regular, and as definite, as consistent as the variation between the different races. This is a fact of life that's before us, and anybody that wants to study it can understand it. I mentioned, I believe, in a previous lesson, the recent medical finding that there was a larger lead content in the blood of the Negroid races than of any of the other races, the black races I'm speaking of. And they, at this point, do not know why. I don't make any sort of projection as to why. I don't know exactly what difference they make. They did mention in that report that the lead content in the blood affected the ability of a person to learn. And I don't know what all is involved in that. I don't know what will be learned. I don't know what racial implications or what wild claims, what prejudice statements may be made from that by men of clear-cut and wild prejudice. I don't know what suits may come out of that against the races that are making a great stand against the show of differentiation. It's hard to tell, but nevertheless, the report has been made. And it is quite obvious from various attributes that we see in different groups of people that there are many differences. There are differences in initiative that the people have, the differences in tendency to maintain dominion, differences in tendency to be domineering and dominable in various groups of people. All of these things are very obvious. They are there. I don't know what to make out of all of them, and that's not the point. I'm simply trying to make the point that there are racial distinctions. This is a known fact that cannot be accepted. Now, thirdly, concerning this known fact, to accept any kind of creation is to credit God either by cause or permission with these differences. In other words, if we simply ignore these differences, we're not dealing with the situation at all. If we say these differences came out of random mutation, then in essence, we are casting our lot with the evolutionist and not with the creationist at all. If we believe in creation, and if we believe that the whole human race sprang from one man, if we believe in the flood and that the earth was overspread from the survivors of the flood, then we very definitely believe that whatever racial distinctions exist today had to be brought about either effectually or permissively by God. And this certainly is well taken in the Bible. If we have any biblical explanation, and we do, it is essentially in Genesis chapters 9 and 10. Now, may I pause here to say I do not understand all that's written here. There's a great deal here that goes beyond me. I try to rightly divide the word and understand it as well as I can, but there's just a great deal more here than I have total understanding of. I might also point out that prejudice in this area, perhaps on my part, or fear of prejudice, might cause me from prevent me from fully understanding some of these things, ignorance of the Word of God, and then a great deal of ignorance concerning history and geography as they coordinate themselves, will be a great enemy in this area. If we could have full knowledge of history and geographical locations of historical events all the way back to the time of Noah, we probably wouldn't have any trouble with this at all. We don't have this. History is not that complete, it's not that accurate, and it's not that honest. And so we don't have all of those things at our disposal. But we do have a biblical explanation of this, and it is in Genesis chapters 9 and 10. May I also add that migration of peoples, name changes of peoples, in other words, nations that were called one thing and later called another, and later called another, nations overcoming nations, national preeminence superseding each other, and then the crossbreeding within these over a period of 4,200 years makes definite identification very, very difficult. For instance, you can go into various parts of the world today and you'll find that you'll have people who are neither Caucasian nor Oriental. There will be a mixture of the two. The Mexican people, for instance, are a cross between the Indians, which previously populated the areas of Mexico, various tribes of Indians, such as the Aztecs and many, many others, and then the Spanish people who came in and who dominated that area, and they crossbred. Same thing is true in the areas of Brazil. You'll find that you have a cross there of the Portuguese people and of the Indian people of that portion of the country, some of the Negroid people of that portion of the country, and you have a crossbreeding there. This makes clear-cut differentiation and identification rather difficult. The Bible does indicate, I think, three categories of people according to the sons of Noah. Now, if you listen to all of the explanations that the world has today, they'll say that we have at least four races. You'll hear them referred to as the white race, the black race, the yellow race, and the red. Or at least that's the way that they normally categorized them when I was a child going to school. And they thought of the Indian or the red man and the Oriental being the yellow, and they thought of them as being quite different. Now, the fact of the matter is that the Indian is not red. He is brown, nor is the Oriental red. He's also brown, but brown of a lighter color with a little more yellow pigmentation in his skin normally. And the Negro is not necessarily black, though they vary from stages of being very, very black to stages of being brown, and some of them even lighter than many Indians. I've known Indians who were darker complected than other Negroes that I've known. I have known Chinese and Japanese that were darker in complexion than some Indians that I've known. And so there's variation and overlapping variation that makes this very difficult. But it seems to me that we do have three sons of Noah, and the statement that these three overspread the earth, and I think that it is accurate to conclude that we have three basic racial differences, and that those three differences are essentially bound up in these three men. The first one of these that we want to deal with is Japheth and his offspring. Now, according to Genesis chapter 10 and verse 21, Japheth was the oldest of the sons of Noah. It says, unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder. Now, if you look there, you'll find that Japheth is stated as being the elder, and he is Shem is the brother of Japheth, who was the older. So Japheth seemed to be the oldest of the children of Noah. Now then, it seems to me, as we study the Scripture, that he is the father of the Gentile nations. Let's go to Genesis chapter 10 and read verses 1 through 5. Now, these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and unto them were born sons after the flood. The sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog and Media and Java and Tubal and Meshach and Tyrus, and the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz and Ridphath and Togarma, and the sons of Javan, Elisha and Tarshish and Kittim and Dodanim. By these, now notice, and I didn't get all those names right, I'm quite sure. You can fix them all up and get them right, that'll be fine. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, even after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. Now I want you to notice that the nations, the isles of the Gentiles, were populated by the sons of Japheth. So we don't really have any reason to question that the Gentile people, or that which is referred to here as the isles of the Gentiles, is essentially the offspring of Japheth. Now, commonly when we think of Gentiles as a category, we think of all who are not the offspring of Abraham or of Jacob. And if you're categorizing it that way, it may be so. They're also referred to at times as Greeks. However, as we look at this in a more precise division, you'll understand that he's referring to the Gentiles here as being the people that were the offspring specifically of Japheth and not of Japheth as well as Ham. In other words, he says that Japheth was the father of the Gentile nations, the isles of the Gentiles. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. Now, whatever else that means, it does indeed mean that the Gentiles are the offspring of Japheth. Now, these apparently constitute all the Caucasian nations. There might be some controversy in that area, but I believe that we can be relatively conclusive, and I think reasonably accurate, in the conclusion that the Gentile nations are the offspring of Japheth. Not only that, but they seem to be the race of the greatest dominion. By that I mean the race that is most predominant as far as ruling the world. In the curse that Noah put upon Ham, I want to reread some verses that will give you insight into this. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew that what his younger son had done unto him. And he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." Now notice, "And God shall enlarge Japheth." The indication seems to be that Japheth will be more numerous than the other brothers as far as the population of the world. "He shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." And when we speak of his enlargement, we're not necessarily talking about the population of the world, for the population of others may outgrow that. We're talking about the areas of the world that are controlled by. And he is to dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And so we find Japheth in this position, it seems, of the greatest dominion throughout the world. And I tell you, you can study history, and you're going to very clearly find that down through the ages, though there have been other strong kingdoms, there have been other kingdoms of great valor and strength and importance, and yet, if you'll take history as a whole from the time of the flood and following, you're going to find that the Japhetic people or the Caucasian people have essentially, through most of the years, through the largest amounts of time, been the people who have been the rulers of the world. Now, there are exceptions to that. We won't deal with them at this point. Nevertheless, we find that the prophecy concerning Japheth there is rather obvious. Secondly, we want to talk about Ham and his offspring. I would like to talk with Ham. There are a couple of questions I'd like to ask him that might give us some real insight into this that apparently God didn't necessarily want us to have. One of the things we know about Ham is that he was the youngest of Noah's sons. Genesis chapter 9 and verse 24, Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. And now someone has said, well, the Bible doesn't say that he was the youngest, but just that he was the younger, and that that Japheth was the elder. However, these words, as used in the English Bible, younger and elder, do indeed mean exactly what we would mean, since they're not used as being compared to another particular person. They would mean what we would mean when we say he is the youngest or the oldest in the family. So there's no question in my mind that Ham was the youngest. Now his name, Ham, is from the Hebrew word Kam, which we would pronounce not C-A-L-M, but K-A, or K-H-A-W-M. And this means to be hot or to wax hot. We would say to grow hot. And some writers infer that this means burned. I don't actually know that the word Ham means burned. There are those who emphatically state that the word Ham means burned, and that Ham himself would of necessity have been a person who, over a period of time, grew burned or black. And I don't know if that's true. I don't know that it isn't true, but I don't know that it is. I'll just leave you that to think about, to kind of kick around in your mind, but I don't know. Now, Cush was the oldest son of Ham. And not only was Cush the oldest son of Ham, but he is the one of whom we have the greatest area of lineage as far as what we know about him. I want us to read in the sixth verse of the 10th chapter. And the sons of Ham, Cush and Mizraim and Phut and Canaan, and the sons of Cush, Sheba and Havia and Sabta, and Raamah, and Shabtika, and the sons of Raamah, Sheba, and Dedan. And Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. And he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, I'm told that this term mighty hunter is not speaking of one as hunting game, but in the sense of one being a conqueror, or a great leader as far as a world leader, or one involved in conquest. And verse 8 would seem to be, would seem to corroborate that, because it says he began to be a mighty one in the earth. Now, we can go on and follow out the offspring of Ham and these other people, but nevertheless, we find that this word Cush has a meaning, as do all of these words. The word Cush comes from the very same Hebrew word as the word Ethiopia. It's rendered the same word, the same Hebrew word as Ethiopia, is Cush. And it is repeatedly that way. So we ought to be able to learn something of that, that Cush was the head of that which became the Ethiopian people. And as you know, the Ethiopian people were black people. Mizraim was the father of those who settled the upper and lower Egyptian areas. Now, there is some disagreement among people as to what the color of the Egyptian people actually is. Is it black, or is it oriental in color? Is it yellow? And of course, as most of you know, the Egyptian people are certainly not as dark-skinned as the Negroid people or the Ethiopian people, and yet they're certainly not a white-skinned people. Now, there have been various rulers and dynasties in the areas of Egypt that have not necessarily been the original populators of the land of Egypt, and so because of that, we have some variations in color. Most of you have seen the recent ruler of Egypt who was just recently assassinated on television. And you remember the darkness of his skin, and he actually looked more Negroid than he did Oriental in his appearance. And, of course, as you know, he was from an upper portion of the land of Egypt, and there's a great deal of variation there. Nevertheless, Mizraim was the father of those who settled that area. Canaan was the father of the Canaanites. Essentially, the Canaanites were black people, though not without any variation. But it is thought by most that the Canaanites were black people. Now, we cannot be utterly conclusive concerning these things. As I pointed out, migration of people, crossbreeding of people, and all of these things have made a lot of this very difficult, in fact impossible, for us to be absolutely dogmatic about, and I think it would be inordinate to be dogmatic in those areas. But most people agree that Ham is essentially the father of all of the black races. In other words, they agree that Japheth is the father of the Caucasian races, that Ham is the father of the Negroid races, though not all of the offspring of Ham is necessarily Negroid. We're not implying that at all, but that he is the father of all of the Negroid races, and that Shem is the father of all of the Oriental, the Semitic races. We'll get to that in a moment. As I said, we cannot be utterly conclusive in this area, and I'm not trying to be. Now, it is notable that the curse of slavery was specifically pronounced upon Canaan, not upon Ham. As strange as it may seem, we find no record of Canaan doing anything sinful. We find that it was Ham's sin that brought this curse about. Canaan was his youngest son. And it seems likely to me, and I'm not sure that this is accurate, but it seems likely to me that the curse that was pronounced upon Ham, or the judgment on Ham, was indeed upon Ham and extended all the way through his family, even to his youngest son, culminating itself. Now, understand that is a conclusion. It is not a biblical revelation. It's a conclusion that I draw from several other things that are set forth in the Bible, and I don't have time to get into all of that. And again, I want you to be sure it is a conclusion. It is not a biblical revelation. But it seems likely to me that this curse extended through Ham, that it was upon Ham, upon his sons, extended all the way through his sons, and culminated in Canaan, his youngest son. Let it be known that whatever the curse of slavery is, and this was a curse of slavery, and again it was placed by God and not by Noah. I've heard those say, well, you know, I couldn't accept the Bible because Noah was supposed to be a great man of God, and we find the imprecatory prayers of Noah against or the imprecations of Noah against his son Ham, against the grandson. Well, let me tell you something. Noah did not have the power to pronounce curses upon people that extend through races at all. He was simply pronouncing that which God, the judgment which God made. It was God's curse. And this curse did involve slavery. There is no question about that. Canaan was to be a servant of servants. Some think this means that he was to be a servant more than all of the rest, or more frequently a servant than the rest. There are those who think it means that the sons of Ham would all be servants, and that Canaan would be a servant even of those servants. Probably there is some truth in all of that. Nevertheless, we find that Canaan was to be the servant of Shem, and apparently the servant of Japheth. In fact, very clearly, that Canaan was to be the servant of Japheth. If you go back and read verse 27 of the 9th chapter, God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And then we find the curse being brought upon Canaan particularly in verse 25, and he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, shall he be unto his brethren." That's the reason that we would indicate that he's a servant to more than one. He was a servant to his brethren. And so the curse of servitude and slavery is rather complex, and we couldn't put circles around it and say that's exactly it, and that's all of it, and that's all it amounted to. We don't know that much about it. The thing that I want to bring out is this, that the curse of slavery is set forth in the Bible, and it is pronounced upon Canaan and upon his offspring. But it is no man's responsibility to enforce it. Now, there have been those who have concluded that Canaan was black, whether they were right or whether they were wrong, and that the offspring of Canaan were the black races, the offspring of Ham were the black races, and that the pronunciation of slavery was placed upon them by God. Be that as it may, whether all of that is right or not, and could not be conclusively proven, nor can it be conclusively disproven. A good argument can be given in either direction. If you're interested in hearing arguments, and I dare say that an argument better in either direction than any of us are prepared to give, I mean by that myself or any of you that are listening to me, in either direction, probably men that could persuade us in either direction. But however those arguments are given and however conclusive they may be, this one thing is certain, that whatever the curse of slavery is, it becomes no man's responsibility to enforce it. In other words, to enforce slavery upon another man is sinful, regardless of whether the curse of slavery is pronounced upon that man or not. The fact that some kind of judgment is to be brought upon a man does not mean that we are to be the instruments of that judgment voluntarily. For instance, the Lord said, "It is impossible but that offenses will come, but woe unto them by whom those offenses come. It had been better for him had a millstone been tied about his neck and he be cast into the sea than that he offend one of these little ones." We find the same basic principle set forth in the book of Acts, chapter number 2 and verses 22 and 23, him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, "Ye have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain." God ordained the crucifixion of Christ, and yet the men were not charged to carry it out, and the men who did carry it out sinned grievously in doing so. Well, what then of the scriptures that seem to be so tolerant of slavery? In other words, we find in the Old Testament that the Israelite people were permitted to own slaves. Not an Israelite as a slave, but they were permitted to own slaves. We find even when we come to the New Testament, we don't find the disciples speaking out against slavery, and we find even men who owned slaves, such as Philemon, who was the owner of Onesimus, was not rebuked for owning the slave. And Paul, in fact, sent Onesimus back to Philemon, not just as a servant, but as a brother. But he also sent him back as a servant or as a slave, if Philemon so chose to keep him in that capacity. What of this? What does this mean? Well, whatever else it means that the Scripture does not always address itself to the complications or even the flaws that exist within society at a particular time. For instance, we find the Bible writing of polygamy. The Bible very clearly teaches that it's God's plan that every man shall have his own wife and every woman her own husband. And the very implication of that and the statement that from the beginning God said they two shall be one flesh, and all of those things indicate that God is not the author of polygamy, that polygamy never pleased God, and yet God dealt with and used some men that were polygamous men. That does not mean he sanctioned it. God used some men who were murderers. That does not mean that God sanctioned their killing. God used some men who were thieves, and God used men who were adulterers throughout the Bible, does not mean that he sanctioned their sin in any sense. And so it is in the area of slavery. It's wrong for us to conclude that because the pronouncement of servitude was placed against any man or group of men, that it becomes the right of another man to enforce that upon them. Or that because the sentence of death is pronounced against a man, that it becomes our right to go out and kill him, unless we are legally endowed with that responsibility. It doesn't mean that because God permitted some of these things that he's justifying them at all. Now, fourthly, We need to deal with Shem and his offspring, and I perhaps have not left myself quite enough time for that, but we'll be dealing with it in other areas later on, I'm sure. Since Japheth is the oldest and Ham the youngest, then logically Shem has to be the second born to Noah. Now, it's relatively common that God chooses to use the second born. You remember that Jacob was the second born, Esau his elder brother, and this is pretty much the pattern that God uses throughout the Bible. Now, concerning Shem, you also will find in the New Testament the pronunciation of his name or the spelling of his name in the lineage of Christ being not S-H-E-M, but S-E-M. It is the same as Shem, Sem and Shem, the same, essentially the same name. And this is the word from which Semitic comes. You hear people talking about someone being anti-Semitic, and to be anti-Semitic means to be against Shem or the offspring of Shem. Shem is the father of the Oriental peoples, and in my opinion, this includes the Indian races. Now, I do not intend to imply all of the Indian races or anything of that sort. I know that there's crossbreeding there, and there's a great deal of information that would probably be at least not easily available to us as to all of the offspring of Shem. But I do believe that Shem is essentially the father of the Oriental peoples, of the Indian peoples across the country, which would probably include the Eskimos of North America and many of the Indian tribes of South America and so on. Though we don't have biblical revelation of where all of those came from. A great deal of time has elapsed, and a great deal of immigration has taken place meanwhile. Shem is the only of the sons of Noah with a total lineage. In other words, you begin here looking at the generations of Noah. You can tie that back to the generations of Adam. And of Seth, and come right on down through Noah, all the way on down to Abraham. And then when you come to the New Testament, you can go in the Gospel of Luke and in the Gospel of Matthew, and you can trace backwards, right through the lineage of Shem. So we learn a great deal from this, and this is, of course, because Shem is in the bloodline of Christ. That's the reason that his lineage is revealed in the Gospels. It's also notable that he is the only one where his lifespan is revealed. This is not extraordinary, again, because it is the lifespan of the spiritual line through whom Christ came that we have this revelation. That's how we arrive at the time periods all the way down through those ages. And you'll notice that Shem lived to be 600 years old. And incidentally, he outlives Abraham by about 33 years. Now, a lot of people are amazed at this, but if you'll take the ages of these men and study, you'll find that Shem actually outlived Abraham. So from these three men, these three sons of Noah, are the races of the earth populated. And though we have a great many questions, and I've left you with a great many questions, I know, after this brief and very imprecise lesson, at least it'll give you some kind of a foundation of seeing where biblically the races and the nations of the earth sprang from.